Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is podcast 57 for December. It's so hard to keep track of the date. December.
It changes so often. Every day it changes.
December 6th, 2011. And I already said podcast 57, right?
Yes.
Okay. Good. And if you're new to the podcast, you're going to be wondering what is going on. But we're pretty casual. I'm Ben.
I'm Kai.
We have a guest with us today, John.
Howdy.
That's John. And even though he said howdy, he's not from Texas, and yet he is.
Not anymore. It bled over a little.
So John's our guest, and we're just going to kick things around with him. And we wanted to cover something that we teased about in yesterday's podcast. We had actually intended to talk about it, and then we got rambling on about something else. I can't remember what it was.
I don't know, but I'm pretty sure it was something shiny and sparkly, and we got distracted because we're magpies.
It doesn't take a lot to distract us. But we were going to talk yesterday about Kai's adventures in buying milk.
Yay!
And this is not raw milk.
No,
right?
No. Well, yes. But milk activists. How sad is it that there has to be milk activists?
Well, when it's illegal in, 44 states, then yeah. I think there needs to be activists.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that they call it real milk. But yes, it's. I went to South Carolina for Thanksgiving to be with family, mm-hmm. and South Carolina has raw milk that's legal to just, go to the store and buy.
Now they have it in the stores, you're saying?
Well, they could if any store wanted to stock it, but most grocery stores
they probably have liability
aren't.
Issues.
Yeah. So we had to buy it at a. It's called a farm store. It's not actually on a farm, mm-hmm. but it's, you see these a lot. They're sort of these roadside farm
small
stores.
Small country store sort of places.
Yeah, and you go in and they have like tomatoes and they actually have a lot of tomatoes because it was the end of November, but they had milk and they had, meat and ice
raw
cream.
Eggs
and yeah.
Raw eggs and raw milk.
Shocking.
How are they alive?
I'm really expecting sometime in the next, 20 to 30 years for raw eggs to be
outlawed.
I
don't doubt it.
They've already got in-shell pasteurized eggs that are beginning to creep into the market, and I really honestly think that that's where we're moving towards.
I wish I had the quote in front of me, but somebody, some big shot, I think he was I don't think he was an FDA person. I think he was a university-related person who gets money from the FDA through any of the many tentacles that support the university system. But he made the comment that no food sold in America should be raw, that everything should be whatever the terminology they use.
Pasteurized or irradiated.
He was talking about irradiation.
Yeah.
And he wanted everything, literally everything, to be irradiated before it was sold. And, that's so goofy. It's like, how long
it's
humans...
It's basic biology. It won't work.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's look at it the two different obvious ways. Now, either human beings were the product of unique creation and placed on this planet by some kind of higher entity of whatever kind, or they were not, and they evolved here on this planet through a long series of processes, or a blend of the two. You could actually say a deity created them through a long series of processes. But however you view the origin of mankind, this planet and these things around us are in constant flux, constantly changing. And so if you create an environment where humans are eating a food that's sterilized like that, then what you do is, obviously, you do a couple things. You weaken the human immune system, and you create opportunities for other entities, other creatures, germs or bugs or whatever, to adapt to whatever it is that you're trying to sterilize that with.
And you can see this very highly in raw milk, in that pasteurized milk. cannot be consumed by people who are lactose intolerant because mm-hmm. they don't have the enzyme lactase to break down the lactose, the, mm-hmm. The milk sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And this enzyme is present in raw milk.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people who are lactose intolerant can drink raw milk just fine
yeah.
because it already has those enzymes. But through the pasteurization process, those enzymes are broken down and they're not effective anymore.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what we're forced to drink through, you know, the federal mm-hmm. government and their yeah. regulations.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they have the nerve to tell you, well, you know, studies have shown that you're better off if you drink milk. Well, I'd love to drink milk, but you don't allow it out. You don't allow me to.
I found it completely shocking this week that I had never realized that grocery stores don't sell whole milk anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't even say whole milk on the container. It yeah. just says vitamin D milk.
Yeah.
And I don't know when this switch was made. Clearly, I wasn't paying attention. but it happened at some point, and I was very shocked to find that out
yeah.
and kind of appalled.
Yeah. yeah. That you don't even have the choice. You can't go to the store. I mean, you can go to specialty stores, and you can buy non-homogenized whole milk,
mm-hmm.
but you can't go and buy a gallon from your normal grocery store of whole milk.
Yeah.
All of the milk has been skimmed to some degree or the other, and then they just say, they don't tell you how much
mm-hmm.
this vitamin D milk has been skimmed, and they
right.
lead you to believe that it's the same milk you've always bought, but it's
yeah.
not.
And clearly it's not.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about all this, of course, John, you mentioned it, you mentioned it earlier. All the dairy products sold in the U.S. are controlled and monopolized through government authority.
Mm-hmm. Through the FDA.
Yeah. All the dairies are licensed and authorized and inspected, and all of their processes and all the prices and all the standards are all controlled by the government.
Yeah. And it's all very standardized. You don't
yeah.
find a lot of difference in the price of milk
mm-hmm.
no matter what region of the country you're in.
Yeah, it's all controlled. It's all price controls. And the economists listening to that should immediately know that price controls always damage the market.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Price controls never produce a good result in the market. So, and you don't even necessarily have to know every detail of what it's messing up to understand that if there are price controls, it's damaging the market.
Right.
So you have the government using its authority to decide how much fat is in milk. And then the government's constantly telling us that fat is bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
the government is constantly telling us, you know, how much fat we should have in our diet. And then they're taking that extra fat out of the milk, and what are they doing with it? Well, they're making butter, they're making cheese, they're making ice cream, and all these things are more expensive than milk.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and more damaging to a human body.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily butter. Butter's pretty healthy if you get it in the right way. But like ice cream,
mm-hmm.
you know, the milk fat itself is not damaging.
Mm-hmm.
But
when you just drink
sugars, chemicals,
or
and sugars,
corn
and
syrup,
preservatives.
Yeah.
yeah.
You know,
corn
and suddenly
solids.
You take this product that your body knows how to digest, and it knows how to deal with it, and it can handle it quite effectively.
Uh-huh.
And now you've turned it into a non-food item that
mm-hmm.
it shoves away in a fat cell.
Yeah.
And yay, progress! Thank goodness
and
we have... No, that's ridiculous.
And I find it funny how much better the real milk tasted over what, you know, we've been fed in the grocery stores for years.
Yeah.
I never liked drinking milk. You know, if I ever did, it was on cereal or
mm-hmm.
it was, you know, was loaded with chocolate syrup.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, trying some of this raw milk, the real milk from South Carolina, it was very good.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed it.
It was so funny because I poured a glass of it in South Carolina and I handed it off to, you know, my new family members and
mm-hmm.
my in-laws. And, they were like, it's weird. It's got stuff floating in it. Yeah, it's supposed to. I find it so sad that in this society, we don't even know what food looks like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of this scene in that movie. What is the name of that movie? Idiocracy.
Yeah.
And I don't mean insult toward your family. I don't
right,
mean it that
right.
way. But when they're like, water, you mean from the toilet?
Yeah, it's, you know.
You want to drink out of the toilet?
No, that mentality of you don't even, you've been so isolated from what food really is for mm-hmm. so long that you have no idea where your food comes from. You have no idea how it's made.
Mm-hmm. How it should taste.
Yeah, it just shows up in the grocery store and you eat it.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't know the difference between a Chips Ahoy cookie mm-hmm. and an actual cookie.
Yeah, that someone has baked.
Yeah.
You've been desensitized to real food.
Mm-hmm. And because this artificial food is so pumped full of artificial things, mm-hmm. it makes your body into this, you know, you suddenly think that that's better.
Yeah.
You know, you want that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want real food anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you want this chemical junk-filled food, and your brain goes, that tastes better.
Well, we're fed, you know, these lines from advertising agencies and from consumer groups telling us that this is good for us.
Mm-hmm.
This is vitamin D fortified. This is whole grain. This is, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not. It's not any better for us.
Mm-hmm. And vitamin D just kills me, in, especially when they add it to, you know, you see... You see people drinking skim milk mm-hmm. with vitamin D added. Well, why do you need the vitamin D added? Well, the calcium in milk can't be absorbed unless you have adequate amounts of vitamin D.
Yeah.
And because we've demonized the sun, mm-hmm. we are suddenly vitamin D deficient. So they go, okay, well, we need to supplement the milk mm-hmm. with vitamin D so people can process the calcium. Except
vitamin D is fat soluble.
Right.
You need the fats, you know, being taken in through the milk in order to process the vitamin D.
Oh, right. Lord. So if you're drinking skim milk with vitamin D to absorb the calcium.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting nothing.
Yeah.
Drink
water. You're
wasting
the vitamin D, and you're not processing the calcium.
Yeah.
The sun question is another little pet peeve of mine.
Mm.
And going back to my thing that I said a minute ago, we have a variety of people with different beliefs. Some people believe that that a supreme being created humans and put them on this planet for a purpose, and some people believe that that we evolved on this planet over eons of time. Or whatever combination of the two, but realize that sun has been here the whole time.
Right.
This is not a new sun that we just got dropped in on us. And so would a benevolent God...
Unless you're a Scientologist.
Well, okay, but I really don't care if they're part of our audience or not. We can
in
mock
which case
them.
You have bigger logical issues
that
we
can't
even deal
problems.
With.
So hey, don't worry about vitamin D. Let's talk about psychotic beliefs. But... I don't mind offending those people, but no matter where you believe on the, you know, evolution to creation scale, that's been the same sun the whole time. Mm-hmm. Whether we evolved under that sun and therefore are purely adapted to that mm-hmm. sun, or whether a benevolent God put us on a planet with that sun over us,
right.
What kind of a twisted God would put us on a planet where the main source of energy for that planet is cancer?
Would kill us?
Yeah,
right.
That's goofy.
And what kind of horrible, you know, genetic malfunctions are we if we've evolved to live under
this
sun and we can't tolerate being under the sun?
Yeah.
Like, clearly, nature's trying to kill us. Maybe we...
And I don't know. Has the sun mysteriously gotten stronger in the last 40 years? I don't think it has, but...
Well, that would explain global warming.
Yes, global warming.
Should we take that one on? Holy moly.
It's funny how every single, just, you know, I don't want to get into the whole thing with global warming.
Climate change.
Right, climate change. But every single summer,
mm-hmm.
people say, this is the hottest summer ever, it's mm-hmm. because of global warming.
Yeah.
And then... Every winter, when people are saying, this is the coldest winter I've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
people say, that's because of climate change.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is, I think the media, it drives us to a certain... Because they have to sell their stories every single day, every
right.
single day. So they find, you know, what the record temperature was in Hoboken this time of year. And then they find some, you know, well, what do you know? There's a drought in West Texas. Well... When was there ever not a drought in West Texas?
There's always at some point.
Yeah, there's always a drought somewhere, and there's always record cold somewhere. And the more you look, and the more you the more we communicate these things, the more we count them.
Yeah.
So if you're if you're counting goldfish in a bowl, then you might be able to accomplish that goal and count those goldfish. But if you're counting goldfish that are in a moving stream, then your count means nothing.
Right.
Because it's constantly changing.
And, we've talked about this before, that human beings need desperately to see order.
Yeah.
And they need desperately to see patterns.
Yeah.
And so when you have all of this random information that really honestly doesn't mean anything,
mm-hmm.
and then you put the incredible power of a human mind behind it and say, find a pattern.
Yeah.
They will find a pattern, and they will find whatever pattern they're looking for.
It's human nature to look for some sort of design, some sort of order, some sort of pattern, and to try to rationalize it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it makes us feel more secure when we can do
that. Like we're in control.
Yeah. Whether we are or not.
And we're not. I get into that all the time because people are like, oh, well, global warming. Well, okay, let's say...
Mm-hmm.
that we can prove that there's a climate change happening and the world is getting more warm. We can't.
Right.
But let's say we can.
And let's say for the sake of conversation that humans caused this.
Well, that's the thing. We can't. Like, one volcano produces more carbon emissions than human beings ever had in their entire history of humanity. To think that we're responsible for it, and then to think that we can... change it is so egotistical of humans.
From research that I've seen and statistics that I've seen, all of humankind, all of our factories, our automobiles, our emissions, everything only accounts for about 3% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So even if all of humanity could leave, a zero carbon footprint, we would only reduce the atmosphere's emissions by 3%, which is nothing.
Now, going back to the creation evolution thing, let's look at it two different ways. Assuming man has evolved and is evolving, then wouldn't the evolution of technology be a natural aspect of our evolution?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, wouldn't we be adapting to whatever that is anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't our future be held in whatever it is that this leads us to, whatever that might be? I mean, at some point, thinking of it evolutionarily, there wasn't a tiny little 2-foot-tall dinosaur that said, man, if I just had feathers, or another little 2-foot dinosaur that said to the other one, you have feathers, you're ruining the environment. It doesn't make any sense evolutionarily to plot that out logically and say, well, we have to alter this because we're going to do this and this. Well, whatever is ahead of us in the future is part of our evolutionary path in that sense, and we'll evolve to it, or we won't.
Right.
And, and then the other side, but that's what we want to avoid. We want to avoid creating something we can't evolve to. We've almost gotten to the point where we can abandon this planet anytime we want anyway.
Right.
So, yeah, so how can one person today, with our limited amount of knowledge that we have, make decisions regarding what humanity is going to be like 5,000 years from now?
Yeah.
And then from the creation side of that, do you really think that this benevolent God created you and created you with all these tendencies to want to create gadgets and then said, but when you get advanced enough to create enough gadgets, you're going to kill yourselves?
And if there is a God, what does it matter?
Yeah, because he'll fix everything or destroy it anyway, according to whatever whatever you believe his whims are.
If you believe that there's a God, any God, it doesn't matter. From, Odin to Hindu gods to, Christianity, there's always an end point with the gods.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a... And then the end of the world happened.
Yeah. Armageddon, Ragnarok.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, there's an end point.
Yeah.
Well, what does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
If there's an evolution, then we want to keep going and we want to make sure that we're alive forever and ever and ever. But there's an end point with religion. This is all going to At some point,
Odin will keep the ice giants away.
Wow, he's kept the ice giants away this long.
I'm not abandoning Odin. I don't care what you say.
Dude, you put an eye patch on, you are Odin.
If I just had an eight-legged horse.
You don't have an English accent, though. I don't know why. Odin always has an English accent in the movies.
That's kind of odd.
Yeah.
I could almost imagine him having a Scottish accent, but that's just because of it, you know. But I would think he ought to be Nordic.
One would think.
It might be that a Nordic accent sounds too much like the Muppet Swedish Chef.
It could be. You can't take that seriously.
Turn the cute ice giants. Okay, now we just lost our entire Scandinavian audience. So.
Come back, Scandinavia.
Oh, my. That was not planned, folks. For any new listeners, our old listeners know this. For any new listeners, we do not script. We kind of get a rough idea of what we're going to talk about, and then we don't follow that.
Yeah.
So we just kind of ramble on about everything.
Which is why the milk discussion got put off till this podcast.
Yeah, instead of the last one.
Hey, we were talking about milk, weren't we?
And that's how we went from milk to Odin and the Swedish Chef.
But the Swedish Chef uses raw milk.
Fraggle
Rock. I bet you he does.
Ragnarok? Fraggle Rock? Ragnarok?
Conspiracy?
Mr. Henson, I'm on to you.
Oh, man.
All right, new topic.
Well, actually, I wanted to touch something on the old. When we were in Missouri, there's a striking difference in the eggshells in Missouri to the eggs that we have here. So when we first got to Missouri and you buy a dozen eggs and you start to make breakfast and you're like pounding on these things trying to get them to break because the shell is way thicker. And then when we came back here in the first morning, because we were out of eggs when we got here, so we had to buy eggs that day. We come in the first morning, I'm going to cook some eggs. It's like smash and they just fly apart because the eggshells here in Ohio are so thin and delicate, you know. And that's has to be the way the chickens are dealt with.
Well, that's a sign of protein deficiency.
I don't know.
Well, this had come up when we were
bugs.
When we were shopping not too long ago. I grew up in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And in Rhode Island, you go into the grocery store, and 90% of the eggs you're going to find are brown eggs.
Really?
Because of the types of chickens they have up there. Mm. Whereas out here in Ohio, they're mostly white eggs.
That was our dog. That was Nikki. Usually almost every podcast has either a dog or a cat or some kind of critter interruption. So that's just kind of an aspect of BadQuaker.com podcast. Rhode Island is, you know, they're so famous they have a chicken named after them. So.
The Rhode Island Red.
You don't hear about the Cleveland Red, do you?
No.
Cincinnati Red, but that's a different thing altogether.
But I think part
and
of that...
And you don't hear about those either.
No.
Only when they lose another game.
But I think part of that is that eggs, because of the delicate nature and the short lifespan, I don't think they get shipped as broadly across the country as a lot of other products that we grow. And I think that the eggs that you get are widely dependent upon the types of chickens that you're using in that particular region.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, the egg producers in southern Missouri have obviously much healthier, chickens.
How was the yolk difference? Was there a color in the yolk?
It was about the same, and about the same flavor. Okay. You know, there wasn't a big
difference. Because that's a
difference.
Huge indicator of how healthy the chicken was, because chicken yolks are really not supposed to be yellow. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be orange, and the orangier they are, the more...
Is that even a word?
It is now.
We're Americans. We make up words. We ain't got no king.
But, yeah, when you crack open a grocery store egg and it's, you know, yellow, that means that chicken's got... that. You know, and they're so proud of it. You know, they label vegetarian raised. Well, a chicken is not supposed to be a vegetarian.
We've done podcasts on that before.
Yeah.
If you want to see a entertaining, however horribly Roman, brutal type execution, throw a snake or a mouse or something into a chicken coop and watch the chickens go nuts.
Yeah.
They are wild, brutal little creatures.
Yeah.
Savages.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's healthy for
yeah.
them. You know, and I know what they're trying to say when they say vegetarian. What they mean is we're not feeding these chickens chickens.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, then, it doesn't come off that way.
Yeah. But then you should say that these our chickens are not cannibals.
Yeah. Which
non-cannibal chickens.
You know, pretty much the only way you can assure that a chicken doesn't eat another chicken is to put them all in individual cages.
Well, that's kind of true. That's the case with birds in general.
Mm-hmm.
Birds are, they're opportunists. They'll pretty much eat anything that doesn't eat them first. Mm-hmm.
So if you have a chickens in a free-range situation, even, mm-hmm. you know, whether that's in a pasture or whether that's in a barn or wherever,
mm-hmm.
If the chickens are not caged
yeah.
and one of the chickens dies, mm-hmm. the other, if you don't get to it before the other yeah. chickens will eat it.
That's
they also like a side of potato chips with their chicken. Chickens love potato chips. I know this for a fact.
I was... I would just see a chicken with a little bib eating his little chips. chicken fingers.
With right. In a recliner with
yeah.
a remote control.
We were staying in Oklahoma at one point, and there was a couple chickens that just had free run of the place. They were out, you know, in the evening, and I didn't have anything to feed them, and I handed them some Pringles, and they would come back every day for more. They loved those things.
Well, now that brings up a good topic switch.
Pringles are not potato chips.
Not,
they're potato
you're right. You're absolutely right.
That wasn't the topic switch I was going for. John, you've spent quite a bit of time on the Renaissance Festival circuits, and so that was one of the reasons that we wanted to bring you on the show and have you share your adventures among the Rennies, as they like to refer to themselves.
I spent about 4 years on the road, and I don't know that I would ever want to go do it again, but I certainly have some war stories from that. So I'd be happy to share and answer any questions you have.
And for any of the new listeners that don't know, Kai also has spent some time on the Renaissance Festival circuits.
I was not as fancy as him, though. He was in a nice trailer, and he only worked for one company, and he got electricity. And
is there a little yeah. snobism there going on?
There is.
I was in the tent world.
Yeah, we generally don't associate with those tent people. They're kind of beneath us.
There was many a day where we were making coffee over an open fire.
It's funny because I think, I can't remember now, I think it's the Discovery Channel or one of the networks on TV is doing a thing on knights jousting.
Have you seen
the commercials for that?
I have not seen
the commercials, but several of my Rennie friends on Facebook have been talking about this. Mm-hmm. And it was actually filmed at the Sherwood Forest Festival in Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know for certain one way or the other, but I just assumed when I saw the commercials that they were going to the Rennie circuits to get that, because
mm-hmm.
really, who else jousts?
Medieval times. Or,
there
yeah,
are
yeah.
professional jousters who joust in tournaments,
mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they do, some of the tournaments are held at Renaissance festivals. Tennessee Renaissance Festival does the circuit jousters,
mm-hmm.
But they, you know, they compete in England and they compete, mm-hmm. you know, jousting
it's
is a sport.
Actually yeah. still an active sport.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just, you know, doesn't really get played on ESPN too often.
Mm-hmm.
So. It should, though. I don't know.
I've actually found real jousting a little boring.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really is.
I think golf is more entertaining.
Less of a chance of people getting killed, though. Although,
true,
not really,
true.
I guess. There have been more deaths by golf than there has
yeah,
jousting.
Especially lightning strikes.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that kind of thing.
The couple of years ago, we had the first person killed in a jousting tournament since...
Oh, I don't know.
King something or other.
Mm. But then again, proportionate to how many golfers there are as opposed to how many jousters there are.
Really?
Yeah, I can't
I don't
imagine
know, that's
there's
a, statistical...
a whole lot of professional jousters left in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's statistics. You can make anything look good or bad using statistics. No, no, no.
Statistician,
no. Well, you know, the old adage, there's, you know, lies, big lies, and statistics.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we did a reference to, the comedian's name slips my mind at the moment.
Is that Hayward Banks?
No, he's good too, but he didn't do Statistician Blues. But I think, was that our last? That one, no, that was like two or three podcasts ago.
I can't keep track of these things anymore. Yeah.
Oh, well, anyway. Todd Snyder, Statistician Todd Snyder. Blues. Anyway, Hayward Banks is the one that does songs like... Wiper blades. He did one song. Hayward Banks did one song in recognition of driving across the Midwest because he was going from gig to gig, from comedy gig to comedy gig. So he did this song, and the lyrics, for some reason, I have the lyrics just right there in my mind. And it's in reference to driving across pretty much any part of the Midwest, like Iowa or Indiana or Illinois or Ohio. And it goes, corn, 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 soybeans, corn, 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 corn. And then you repeat the lyrics after that. So
I've driven through some of those parts of the country, and I can say it's 100% accurate.
Unless you're in Oklahoma, in which case it's armadillo, armadillo, armadillo.
I have, you know, nothing against anyone who lives out in that area, but mm-hmm. that is some very lonely, boring stretches of highway out there. Kansas, Iowa, South Dakota.
Oh, yeah.
So even a lot of Texas, you know, not so much corn, but a lot of desert and prairie.
We owe an apology. This is a good time to correct.
Several podcasts ago, I made mention of the fact that I did a Renaissance Festival in Kansas, and I said that the town that we were in looked like a Depression-era Hooverville that they had just built onto. At the time, I said that was Topeka. I'm sorry, Topeka. It was not. It was not Topeka. I've never been to Topeka. I don't know what Topeka looks like. My apologies to the people, the fine people of the city of Topeka. It was Wichita.
Oh.
Wichita. Okay. Is a Depression-era Hooverville thing just built on to.
So now we lost all the listeners from Topeka who waited for an apology and never got it, so they're gone. And now all the people in Wichita are like, oh yeah, we'll never listen again.
Yeah. Well, you know.
So now is there any other cities in Kansas that we'd like to... We'd like to disparage.
I will say, though, that Topeka's cool because Topeka's the town that changed their name to Google. Mm-hmm. And then their name to Topeka.
That's right. I remember that.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was about, a year ago or so?
Yeah, I don't know.
Everybody
it was
started,
for April Fool's, wasn't it?
I think it was. I think it was April 1st of possibly this year.
Yeah, I don't remember, but that was pretty cool. So Topeka. You're cool. And I really don't want to go there, though, because, you know, Kansas.
Yeah. We had a flat tire once coming across Kansas. Do you recall that?
The person in front of us caught the flat tire, and then we did?
Yeah.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I think
was weird.
Brian was in the back?
Could be.
I don't know.
Yeah. So we had to cut out the part with the dog barking.
Right.
But we're back, and we'll talk about something other than Kansas. Boy, that Kansas. What about Kansas? You know what about Kansas? It's no South Dakota.
Yeah.
South Dakota is actually a very lovely area. Mm. Well, I should say western South Dakota is very lovely. When you get into the Black Hills, you get up towards Mount Rushmore and the Badlands and... Mm. You know, that whole area, it's absolutely wonderful. I went out there for 4th of July for a long weekend about a decade ago, man. Mm. Just had a great time. It was a beautiful area. But eastern South Dakota is very much like the rest of the Plain States.
Yeah.
Long stretches of highway with ridiculously high speed limits and no cars anywhere around and nothing but corn as far as the eye can see.
Now, you're originally from the Northeast, yeah?
Yes. Yes, I grew up in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, that whole area. And, you know, basically traveled a lot because of the Renaissance Fair circuit. So I've seen a great deal of the country doing that. I've been all up and down the East Coast. I've been out to Texas and New Mexico and Nevada and up through Oklahoma, you know, Kansas. You know, it's been a wonderful experience.
What did you do at the in the Renaissance Festival?
Basically, I was a booth manager. Basically meaning that I worked for one particular company. I would go to the Renaissance Fair. I would set up our booth or our tent or whatever we were vending out of, take all the product I had with me, set it up, merchandise it, display it, and then dress up in a funny costume and sell it over the weekend.
So, in essence, I mean, it doesn't appear this way to your average Renaissance Festival visitor, but in essence, it's just business. It is.
In fact, I find the Renaissance Fairs to be probably one of the most pure capitalist societies that you can still find out there. You know, our livelihood depends on being able to make sales, good economic conditions.
Competition.
Competition, absolutely.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, and it's a great way to, you know, dissuade yourself of the notion that anybody but the consumer sets the prices. Because absolutely, if your prices don't fit what the consumer wants to buy, it doesn't matter if your prices are fair based on what it costs you to make it and whatever. If the customer's not willing to buy it,
you don't eat.
Yeah.
You don't get to the next show.
You know, you better figure out how to make it cheaper.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing about economics that so many people don't understand is that prices are consumed. As long as monopolies in force are not brought in by government forces one way or the other, and as long as the market is allowed to adjust itself, and we have squeaky chairs, folks, sorry. But as long as the market is allowed to adjust itself and as long as there's no forced monopolies that take place, then the seller is forced to
be competitive, to adjust to the demands of the market.
And it's really funny because it's not always reducing your price.
Right.
Sometimes it's increasing your price. Sometimes a customer will come into your booth, and if you have stuff that's priced too low for them, they won't buy it.
Because they'll assume it's cheap garbage.
Yep.
So you have to be able to judge the market and adjust your price according to that.
Yep.
I was watching a thing on Food Network one time, and there was a chef that was visiting a local restaurant, and he was trying to teach them how to because they were losing business, and they were getting ready to go out of business, so he's going to show them how to do all this. And so he sat down with them, and he showed them how to figure out the cost of their food and how to take a menu item and decide, you know, what it costs to produce this menu item. And then he starts saying that you just mark it up this much and put it out there. And I thought, no, you're wrong. Because if you're making a particular menu item at a restaurant, let's say you put this together and you figure out that you can sell it at $5 a plate and make money. You're not going to sell that if you're in an exclusive restaurant that typically has $40 to $80 a plate or, you know, a dinner.
Right.
You're not going to sell that $5 item. Nobody wants that because they're going to look at that and think, well, that's not any good.
There's a perception that the food in this restaurant is high end and therefore should cost more.
So you have to, yes, you do have to figure out what your cost is, and you have to cover your cost. And if you can't sell it to the consumer at a price that will cover that cost, then you have to go back to that cost and find out how you can cut corners to make that cost lower.
Right.
Right.
But the real decision maker is the the consumer.
And that's, you know, when you're beginning to price things, what you have to begin with is how much is the customer willing to pay for this? And then you can say, okay, this is how much the customer is willing to pay for this. My competition is selling it at this. So I'm going to sell it at this. This allows me this much profit and I can, you know, and that's how you have to begin doing things. And once you've done that for a while, you can say, okay, generally speaking, this particular item needs to be marked up three times from its, you know, manufacture price. But there have been so many times where standing there in the booth, you're like, this item isn't selling. I'm going to mark it down, or I'm going to mark it up.
Yeah,
you know.
That's one of the great flaws of corporatism, of the bigger corporations, is the larger the corporation gets, the easier it is to get out of touch with that customer relationship. I used to work for a major pizza company that specializes in mostly delivery. And we would get corporate top-down pressure to, like they would tell us, okay, we want to really push extra cheese this month. So we would tell all of our phone people to be sure and upsell for extra cheese on every single pizza. The problem was there was this disconnect in the corporate mind that was telling us, because they just wanted sales to go up, so they thought, okay, if we just have everybody push cheese, you know, as an extra item. The problem is cheese was the most expensive item on the pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you add extra cheese onto the pizza and charge them a dollar for it, we were adding like 80 cents worth of cheese and charging them a dollar.
Right.
Now you say, oh, well, you made 20 cents.
Not really.
Yeah,
the labor involved
exactly.
in putting that extra cheese on there
and whatever
cooking the extra
that it
cheese
takes
right.
the time and everything. On the other hand, if we add something like, and you're not going to sell onions as often as cheese, but compare onions to cheese, if you're selling an extra order of onions on that pizza, well, that extra onion, that extra order of onions literally was like 3 or 4 cents.
Right.
Where the
but
cheese,
you're still charging the extra dollar.
Yeah,
for it.
Yeah. So if you're going to upsell something, don't upsell extra cheese. Upsell them onto a fancier pizza with more
right.
toppings.
Right.
More than likely, though.
Or a butter, you know, crust.
Yeah.
You know, garlic crust or something. You know.
More than likely, what was happening, though, is they were probably getting some sort of federal subsidy from United Dairy Farmers or, you know, some organization.
Actually, there was a scandal about that just about a year ago or so.
Yep.
That, and it involved the same pizza company that I was referring to.
Well, because it's a pizza company that radically overhauled their pizza design.
But we're not going to mention
entirely,
any names.
Right, funded entirely by the federal government through this.
So we have dog barking again.
But anyway, what was I saying?
The federal government was funding the cheese.
Right. And the whole redesign of the product and all of the advertisement for this redesign was funded through this federal agency. And, you know, when you look at it, it doesn't look on the surface like it is, because it's not the federal agency for the blah, blah, blah. You know, it's, you know, the Cheese Council or, you know, the way that it was worded, it sounded like it was an independent
private organization.
Right, and it wasn't.
When in fact, what we have is we have government ownership of massive amounts of cheese that they stash in huge caves.
Mm-hmm.
We did a podcast about that once, that there are literally massive caves stashed full of cheese that the government owns.
Mm-hmm.
And then the government dumps that cheese on the market and controls the prices and forces companies like this pizza company that we're talking about to behave in the ways that they want them to behave.
That's why, you know, going back to the raw milk thing, that's why milk in the supermarket is, I don't even know what, like
$2.50 a gallon.
So,
but buying a gallon of raw milk, that's not pasteurized, that is less intensive work, that literally you just pull it out of the cow, put it in a bottle, put it in the store, is $7 a gallon.
Yeah.
I had mentioned that when we came back. I said, you know, why is it that milk that comes out of the cow is pasteurized, homogenized, fortified, processed, handled, shipped, one-third the price of milk that you just put in a bottle?
Mm-hmm. And again, it's because the consumers are so willing to pay more for it that they are willing to.
And it's two reasons. Number one is that federal government are subsidizing the pasteurized.
Yeah.
And
they strip the cream out of it and use it a dozen different ways.
And the raw milk isn't being subsidized, and it is also basically a black market.
Exactly.
You know, it's not in that it is
It's not illegal, but it's a black market in the fact that there's only, you know, a few states in the country that you can go to purchase it.
Yeah.
Now,
and that artificially drives up the price.
When we say subsidize, we should we're using more pleasant language than really describes what takes place. What subsidizing means, whether you're talking about subsidizing corn prices or rice prices or sugar prices or milk prices or whatever, what you're actually doing is you're forcing some people to pay for something against their will. Mm-hmm. So for example, through taxation, people are forced to support, let's just say, the corn subsidies. And that produces an artificially low price for corn. And the corn farmers then are paid a different wage, mm-hmm. a different amount for the corn that they grow. And then the corn goes out on the market at an artificially low price. Mm-hmm. And what that does, not only have you robbed the people that you took the tax money from to begin with, then you dump the corn on the market at an artificially low price. And then other farmers who are not subsidized, let's say in Mexico, mm-hmm. other farmers who are not subsidized now can't sell their corn at a reasonable market price.
Or anyone who is not using the approved Monsanto genetically modified seeds.
Mm-hmm. Which, well, we shouldn't get into who the head of Monsanto, or who the top executives in Monsanto and how that interlaps with the FDA and the...
yeah, that's not fascism at all.
Well, that's part of why they do it. They are trying to grind their competition into the dust, mm-hmm. and to force a standardized practice.
And it's fascism. Yeah. It's using the tools of the state to promote your own business. And it's not fascism because I don't like it. I'm not calling it fascism because I'm against it. I'm calling it fascism because it is the textbook definition of fascism.
Yeah.
Favoritism.
Yeah. Fascism is not guys with funny mustaches walking weird and with swastikas on there. That's not fascism.
Right.
Fascism is economic process. And these people, the Occupy Wall Street people, as much as I would like to sympathize with them, they are complaining about capitalism. They don't even know what capitalism is.
Right.
They're actually complaining about fascism and they don't even know it.
Yeah. You know? And the state has very carefully, you know, maneuvered itself to where, on the one hand, it sits there and goes, capitalism is evil, capitalism creates all these monsters, we can't leave these corporations to police themselves. And then it uses fascism to make corporations that are huge and evil and taking over the world.
The classic on this is Walter Block, legendary free market and brilliant, brilliant author. Walter Block was on a radio show. I was listening to him, and this was back when the BP spill took place in the Gulf. And he's from he lives in Louisiana, so he's like right there and seeing what's happening, you know, front row seats to this whole mess. And the person says, "Well, if it wouldn't have been for the government, what would we do with this horrible spill in BP?" And Walter Block's like, "If it weren't for the government forcing BP to drill out there at 5 miles down,
where it's unsafe,
they would have been drilling up here where it's 100 feet deep instead." Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they can just go down and fix it.
Yeah, and it's
and
not
that's
a problem.
What kills me, because people are like, "Oh, well, see, without government, this sort of horrible thing would happen. With government, this sort of terrible thing happens. You're not fixing it with government. You're just stealing from people and hurting people, and these same horrible things are still happening."
Mm.
You know, that's, I've made this comment with police before. People say, "Oh, well, you know, if you don't have police, people will just break into your house." People do that anyway. I would rather have that happen, since it's going to happen anyway, and then not be stolen from every day for this police protection that doesn't work. You know?
I'd rather have the freedom to handle the situation myself if that happens.
You know, and that is assuming that a free market wouldn't take care of a police situation.
Yeah.
I think it would. Yeah. But even if it doesn't, we're better off without it. You know?
Yeah.
In Texas, there are a lot less home invasions in Texas because the gun laws are more prolific down there. A lot more people are armed. A lot more people are defended.
Mm-hmm.
So that type of crime doesn't take place as much. The criminals aren't afraid of the police.
Yeah.
Well, they're not breaking into a home thinking, oh, I got to watch out for the police. That's a non-factor when a criminal is breaking into a home. Mm-hmm. What they're thinking about is, what is this homeowner going to do if they're armed?
Yeah.
What are they going to do if they're home?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think the police creates any type of real security.
I'm reminded of a particular comedian and his routine that he does. In the routine, the comedian is speaking to he's taking on a certain persona, and he's speaking to his parole officer in the routine, and the parole officer is telling him he needs to do some kind of public service, and he says, "What about distributing fans to the elderly with this hot summer coming on? You could volunteer to distribute fans to the elderly." And the comedian goes into his routine, and he says, "You know what's better than fans for the elderly is swimming pools." Swimming pools are a lot better than a fan, because a fan is using a lot of electricity, and it's just moving around air in the same room. It's the same air. But a swimming pool, you can get into it, you can cool down, you can come out, and even after you climb out, you're still cooler than you were when you went in, and you've got this window of time afterwards where you cool down. He says, not only that, swimming pools are free. And the parole officer's like, how can swimming pools be free? He says, well, it's basic math. Takes the police about 8 to 12 minutes to respond to your average call. But you can be in and out of a pool in 5 minutes. So, you know, it's free.
Nice.
It's funnier when he tells it. Because I'm not a comedian. You know, if I were a comedian,
right,
I wouldn't be doing this Bad Quaker radio show.
But it's just, it's difficult to, you know, get your head into a space where you can say, you know, it's not better off with the state. It's better off without the state.
Well, generally speaking, the market provides, the market is like, I don't even know. I almost had a comparison there, but I lost it. Like the ocean. If you scoop out a certain amount of the ocean, it immediately fills that back in, and there's no gain and loss. You can't. I mean, in the bigger picture of things, you could say that there is, but there's nothing that's measurable to anybody who's looking. If you scoop out part of the ocean, it immediately fills that back in. And that's the kind of the thing about the market. If there is a need, because when you scoop out water out of the ocean, there's a need there, and so the other water rushes in. Yeah. And the ocean seeks a level constantly. And the market is like that. If you create a vacuum, if you create a need, if you scoop something out,
the market will step in and fill it.
Yeah,
immediately.
It will do so very, very quickly, because it's in someone's interest to do so.
We've talked about this with pie. With attacking Mr. Pie Eater.
Michael Moore.
Michael Moore, yeah.
If we start beating
and then there's no, you know, shortage of pie. If there's a need for pie, people will make pie.
Yeah. If we start beating up Michael Moore, we'll be here another hour. We really should wrap it up anyway. We're getting pretty close to our time limit. John, I want to thank you for coming on the show with us. We didn't really cover very many of the topics we were going to, but that's the way we do this show.
That seems to happen here a lot.
Yeah,
yes. But it was my pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks a lot. And Kai, hopefully we'll get you back on pretty soon. For the new listeners, you may have noticed we had 2 episodes in a row where Kai was on here. About once or twice a week, Kai joins us on the podcast, and the rest of the time you're forced to listen to my insane ramblings. So this was a special treat. Not only did we have Kai 2 days in a row, we had John today, so that was a special treat. If you want to get in touch with us, I am Ben, B-E-N, at badquaker.com. Kai is?
Kai, K-I, at bedquaker.com.
And if you have any input to the website, you can get a hold of the admin there at badquaker at badquaker.com.
Off the album, Bad Quaker.
I'm noticing a theme here.
On our groundbreaking tour, Bad Quaker.
Thanks a lot for listening, folks. And here's where the exit music comes in. The Devil You Know by Ben Stone. There's a way of thinking that has, for some time now, disturbed me. Sometimes it's expressed in the phrase, choose the lesser of evils. However, I find this statement easy to refute by simply asking why I must choose evil at all. It seems to me that if I willingly choose evil to any degree, I'm not only complacent to the evil, but I'm committing an evil act. How can a person of clear conscience intentionally commit an evil act? And once the evil deed is done, isn't attempting to justify it also evil in and of itself? Therefore, choosing the lesser of evils, I have fallen into another old adage, two wrongs don't make a right. Ah, but leave it to the smooth tongue of the Irish to say something completely unacceptable in a way that convinces you to accept it. And that would be, better to have the devil you know than the one you don't. Curiously, as best as I can tell, this old Irish phrase appeared around the same time that second-tier Irish leaders and landowners conspired to assist the Roundhead invasion of Ireland in return for special treatment and payments by one Oliver Cromwell. Perhaps that other saying, speak of the devil and he'll be before you, has a degree of truth to it as well. Also the statement, you get what's coming to you, has some merit. So, in justifying an invitation to the devil, one claims familiarity with said devil. Isn't that an odd method of redemption? Let's hop in our Wayback Machine and try it in some statements. Okay, it's 1972. Yes, I invited Charles Manson to our dinner party because I know him much better than Elvis. Okay, let's crank that dial back to 1938. Well, yes, I invited Adolf Hitler to our bar mitzvah because I know him so well and I've never met Rabbi Rosenthal. And doesn't that work wonderfully? It's funny how if you just say things in a different way, it shines a whole new light on the subject. Let's do one more. It's 442 A.D. Yes, I invited Attila, Prince of the Huns, to the counting house to assist with the audit. After all, I've known Attila since he was a child, and I've never met this General Arnaglissius. Do I get my history geek card stamped for that last one? You can clearly see my point, but some level of concern always lingers when letting go of the familiar and grasping at the unknown. However, Sun Tzu teaches us to always know our enemy, and knowing your enemy is done for the purpose of defeating your enemy, not submitting to him. So then we are left with no practical excuse for accepting evil. We must, if we are to walk our path in life blameless, become familiar with, but refuse to choose evil. If evil is thrust upon us, we must use wisdom in seeking a way to avoid or resist it, but we must never choose to accept it. However, this is only half an answer. If we can be convinced to resist the familiar evil, we must know what it is we are to grasp. So we look back to Sun Tzu, and we see that we are not only to know our enemy, but we are to know ourself. The way to become confident in rejecting evil is by better knowing ourself. The Bible describes the network of tents and ritual objects that the Levite priests used in the ceremonies involving the sacrifice of animals prior to entering the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. That's the Indiana Jones Ark, not the Flood Ark. Before they could enter the main tent, after having brought a lamb to the altar and having slaughtered it, they washed their hands, faces, and beards in a huge basin that had been made by pounding bronze into the shape of a bowl and then polishing it to a gleaming finish. The effect of this highly polished surface covered in water was to create a mirror the priests could look at as they washed to make sure they removed all the traces of the lamb's blood. You see, if you're familiar with the Indiana Jones movie, they didn't want to enter the presence of the Ark with the stains of slaughter still on their hands because it could have adverse health effects. For us, this is an example of knowing ourself. As we examine ourself and become more familiar with that face in the mirror, it becomes easier to understand our friends and neighbors. As we remove the stains of slaughter from our own lives and get better acquainted with our own strengths and weaknesses, we can begin to see ourselves as others see us. The more we do this, the easier it is to understand the choices and actions of others when we interact with them. And the better we know our friends and neighbors, the better we can learn how and when to trust them. As we learn more and more about ourselves and others, we see that people are really mostly the same. Sure, you know, we all have strengths and weaknesses, but most people are not much different than you and me. Most people want the best life possible and prefer that life to be as peaceful as possible. Now, the fear of the unknown can begin to fade away as you learn that your neighbor is not so different after all. You realize at some point in this process that the guy down the street has no more desire to rob you than you do to rob him. Now, that's not to say that there are no robbers. It just means that the average guy down the street is no more likely to be a robber than you are. But what about the real robbers that do exist? Who can we trust to help us with them? Well, if we know one, we could ask a bigger, tougher robber to help us with the robber. Perhaps if we knew a big, strong gang of robbers, we could ask them to defend us from the robbers. But then why would a gang of thieves protect us from other thieves? Well, we could pay the big, powerful gang to protect us from small gangs and individual thieves. Now, that doesn't make much sense, does it? That would be like choosing one evil over another simply based on familiarity. Like, if it were better to have the devil you know than the one you don't. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.